week of July 21st, 2019, this is Showbiz Sandbox episode 456, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in Birmingham, Alabama, where I have not seen Hugh Jackman in concert, I'm Michael Giltz.
Yes, of course. I know exactly what you're referring to because Hugh Jackman, you know, the actor and entertainer extraordinaire. By the way, I just throw the word extraordinaire around like it's I'm giving it away. But he was here in Los Angeles over the weekend.
I saw that on Facebook. Yes, you went to the show.
Yes. And I got to tell you, after the first two numbers, okay, he comes out, he starts singing The Greatest Showman. He's prancing around, throwing his arms up in the air like a peacock, and he's got all the costume changes, and all I could think is he or isn't he?
Is he or isn't he what?
Australian. I mean, that's what I was talking about. What did you think I was referring to?
How was the show?
You know, I'll say this. He's not a very good singer. He's an okay singer.
Yeah.
He's an above average singer. But, he kind of hits all the notes. He sings all the songs.
All the notes. There's an inspiring comment.
You know what I mean.
Was it fun?
Yeah, it was fun. Yeah.
I've heard it feels a little swamped that he's working hard, but the charisma that comes across in a Broadway space, which is like, 1,200 people, is not quite working the same when he's in a big, huge auditorium.
That is 100% accurate. It's definitely, when you have 18,000 people at the Hollywood Bowl, which, by the way, not the greatest place acoustically. They've tried and God bless them, they've tried, and they have made it better over the years, but it's still not the best place to see a show, and or at least listen to a show. And, you're right. He is working overtime, that's for sure.
Was it sold out?
It was 100% sold out, mm-hmm. And I just happened upon tickets. Otherwise, I would not have been going.
You just happened. There they were, lying on the ground.
No, I mean,
You paid for them.
Yes. Oh, yeah, absolutely. There's no free. Yes, absolutely.
1%. I didn't say
I was in the good seats,
did people
by
have
the way.
Fun?
Yes, everybody loved it.
Okay, so they did. Despite your reservations, they all had a good time. Well, people are going to have a good time at Hugh Jackman, maybe on tour. They're certainly going to have a good time listening to our podcast. What will we be talking about?
Well, this week on Showbiz Sandbox, a lot is happening in China. Western companies can invest in China's theater chains, and Shanghai announced its first 24-hour movie theater. But we know two movies they won't be showing. Censors just blocked more films from being shown. By the way, Old Town Road is number one on the Billboard charts, 16th week in a row, tying it with two other songs as the biggest number one hits in charts history.
Despacito and One Sweet Day.
One Sweet Day, what is that?
That's Mariah Carey and Boys to Men.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Actually, we don't have anything to add to that, actually. But next week, if it stays number one, we'll definitely have something to say. Wow. In sexual misconduct news, yes, that little segment is back again. Famed publicist Peggy Siegel could use a publicist of her own, or more likely a damage control expert. Her business is collapsing after Siegel's ties to convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein came under the spotlight thanks to news stories by The Hollywood Reporter and the New York Times. Those are tied in to new allegations of sex offenses by Jeffrey Epstein, or I guess it's sexual assault, really. On Inside Baseball, we'll take a look at the Emmy Awards, which shows will benefit the most from some Emmy love. And with Game of Thrones and Veep saying goodbye, is HBO enjoying a swan song for its dominance? Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover the week's top entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire. There's that word again. Anyway, we're turning it over to Michael Giltz to fill us in on last week's box office and our copyrighted, trademarked. Did I mention copyrighted? Patented. We've basically secured this segment because it's not just the weekend's box office. It's last week's box office. Michael, take it away.
If Amazon can patent, one-click shopping, which is insane, surely we can patent the idea of talking about the entire week's gross. It's public information, but we'll say, no, that belongs to us. We've got a link to ComScore in our show notes. We've also got a link to Box Office Mojo. We pull information from Deadline and the numbers, Variety, Hollywood Reporter, the New York Times, the LA Times, everyone. We're looking at the entire week of July 21st, 2019. 2019, and the number one movie around the world is The Lion King. $476 million last week. It opened up 1 week ago in China, so its worldwide total is now over $500 million, $531 million worldwide. Yet another film that's going to cross the $1 billion mark for Disney. They may have six of them. Five of them, almost guaranteed, will be released this year that gross $1 billion. They may have six.
Now, okay, you said six, maybe seven, right?
I think five, maybe six.
Yeah. Okay, is the sixth one going to be Star Wars, which is released late in the year? Okay.
No, that will be released this year, but it will definitely gross $1 billion worldwide. No, the one question mark is Toy Story 4.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Which I saw, by the way, and it's really good.
I thought it was good, too. I felt it was a little unnecessary at first, but it won me over by the end.
Yeah. I mean, look, yeah. I mean, they know how to pull on those heartstrings.
Right. So The Lion King grossed $530 million worldwide so far. Last week in North America, guess what? Our old friend 3D showed up. The movie grossed... from him in ages.
It's funny because when I got the press release on Sunday, you could tell it was a pre-planned press release that they obviously gave quotes to, you know, ahead of time. But Real D sent a press release and I thought, oh my gosh, $36 million worldwide in 3D. This is, or 36%, something like that. This is gonna set Michael off.
Not 36%, no. In North America, the number that they published was $25 million in ticket grosses came from 3D. That's in North America, is my understanding. So it's certainly not 36% of the worldwide box office. You know, so, but that's, you know, hey, they're factually mentioning it again, which means, whoa. And I think, frankly, most of that is just people had no choice. I think other screenings were sold out and the times they wanted, they just, well, let's go see the 3D. I don't think people were clamoring to see the 3D at all. 25 million, you know, what did it gross in North America over the weekend? It grossed
$200 million, right?
$200 million. So that's barely over 10% over the weekend, which is probably when most of that money was made. You know, it was Thursday through Sunday. So this is just not that impressive. It's 10% of the total box office gross in North America, and it's probably only because they devoted so many damn show times to that. But there you go. Fun to hear from him. It's been a while. Good to see you're in good shape. At number two around the world is Spider-Man: Far From Home, another film that's about to cross the $1 billion mark. It grossed $123 million last week. It's at $970 million worldwide. So that and Aladdin, which is at number six in our chart, it made another $28 million. That's at $988 million. So those two movies are poised to cross the $1 billion mark. And number three is Toy Story 4. That made another $88 million worldwide. Animated films, especially well-reviewed, well-enjoyed ones, tend to have really good, strong legs. So this is at $860 million worldwide, $140 million more. It's possible. It could do it. This, too, could cross the $1 billion mark. And you know what? The Lion King is going to do it. Those three other movies may well do it. And I looked back at the score for the original Lion King. That movie grossed, where is it? $968 million worldwide. It only needs $32 million to cross the $1 billion mark. Hey, how about a reissue at the tail end of this remake? Throw it back out there.
By the way, so I just looked this up. It was 36% of the $531 million worldwide gross to date.
Worldwide,
3D,
that's of course
Real D.
That is of course way down from what it was in the heyday. So even worldwide overseas, it's not going. In the U.S., it was more like 12% of the total gross. So that shows you how far it's fallen. At number four is a Chinese film, Looking Up. This is a big, big box office hit. It's sort of stomping a bit onto The Lion King's grosses in the Middle Kingdom. They'll put that in context. The first the animated film made almost nothing in China. This one has already passed the $100 million mark. It's doing just fine. It's not going to be a monster hit, but it's making good money for Disney in China. But Looking Up sort of stomped all over it. $51 million it made. It's at a $61 million total. I'm not sure when it opened up. I think there were lots of early early advanced screenings to drum up publicity for the film. They went all over the country pushing this movie. It's about an astronaut who's in space, and he's stranded a little bit, and he's thinking back on his life and his father. And so most of the movie is a flashback looking at the relationship between a father and a son. It's a dad who rejects standardized testing, rejects all that pushing for you must meet these metrics, and he encourages a child to be creative and dream and reach for the stars. And it all worked because the kid became an astronaut. So it's a heart tugger. It's doing very, very well. It's at $61 million total in China. At number five is another Chinese hit. It's The White Storm 2, Drug Lords. Actually, it's a Hong Kong hit. $36 million it made over the weekend. It's a, look at me. I did the same thing. I apologize. I said weekend.
Oh, okay.
What a horrible person I am. It made $36 million last week. It's at $175 million total. And yes, it takes retraining, doesn't it? Just to say not weekend. We've been so used to saying, even though the weekend for the last few years has been 4 days long, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, we still say weekend, even if it includes Monday totals, all over the weekend. So we're working hard to make sure that that's not the case anymore. Aladdin, we already mentioned, that's about to pass the $1 billion mark. At number seven is another big hit, the horror flick Annabelle Comes Home, $23 million last week. It's just about to pass $200 million worldwide. At number eight is The Secret Life of Pets 2, another $19 million. You can see how that has really strong legs, just like Toy Story 4 can expect. That just passed $318 million worldwide.
But you know, you could say it has a strong four legs since it's about pets.
Sure. At number nine is Yesterday, the Beatles flick. That made $18 million last week. A friend of mine saw it and said, it's what you would expect. You know. It's okay.
Yeah.
If you want to see it, if you've got AMC Pass, as she says, I know you do, it's worth it. It's okay. If you had to pay for it, maybe not. That passed the $100 million mark. At number 10 is Crawl, the horror flick monster flick in a way, with out of control alligators. $16 million it made last week. It's at $33 million worldwide. At number 11 is Stuber, the Uber comedy, which is not so comedic, but it made $10 million last week. It's at $21 million and counting. And it's sort of the jumping off point for a story in the trade saying, you know what? People are talking more and more about variable pricing. Okay, Disney is dominating the box office so much. Should the Avengers and should the Lion King be the same price as Stuber? And people say, no. It should not be the same price. Look at Stuber. They looked at the weekday grosses. On Tuesday, Stuber made like $1.4 million, almost the same amount it made on from Sunday, more than it made on Monday, more than it's going to make on Tuesday or on Wednesday or Thursday, because Tuesdays have discount prices all over the country. AMC, for example, only charges $5 wherever you are if you go see a movie on Tuesday. And they're saying, hey, isn't this example? We should try variable pricing. What do you say, Spurman?
Or they call it dynamic pricing, and it is definitely taking off. There is a question as to whether it will work, because when you go to the movies, you expect there to be one price for everything.
No, you don't.
But here's the thing. You know, it used to be, you know, you would go and you'd spend your $10, but that $10 became $11, or maybe it was $12, or maybe it was $13.50. Who knows what it was? Maybe it's $8. Who knows? In other words, the price is changing all the time, usually up, by the way, that you don't know what it's going to be anyway. So you may as well go and figure out when it's cheapest to go. If you fly on a Tuesday, it's cheaper than if you fly on a Friday or a Saturday.
That's true. Dynamic pricing to me means we're going to charge as much as we possibly can. So if Hollywood is saying we want to charge more for bigger movies, they're making a big mistake. If they're saying we need to charge less more and more often because we've gone too high. So Taylor Swift is not walking around saying, how can I get people to buy tickets for less? She's walking around saying, how can I get people to pay $300 for a ticket to my show? What can I do to make them pay $400? So Hollywood's been doing that. They're going to say, hey, we'll toss in 3D glasses. We'll toss in a nice screen and call it a large format and say, you got to pay more for good picture and sound quality. So that doesn't work. If you're trying to pay more, that's what dynamic pricing means in my head. But if you're saying
variable, and I think I take your point. I agree with you.
Movies are priced too high. The point is not that we should have variable pricing or dynamic pricing. It's that they should lower the ticket price for movies.
Most of the dynamic pricing schemes that I've seen, usually in presentations or in execution, it's there not necessarily to raise the price, but to fill unwanted space.
Well, we already know that weekdays are empty. And early screenings are empty, and they've got the theater space. And guess what? Hollywood's been doing dynamic pricing or variable pricing for as long as I've been alive. There have almost always been discount Tuesdays. There have almost always been matinee prices. There are almost always cheap prices for children and seniors. This is not a new thing. I've been going to the movies a lot with my AMC pass, and I'm surprised every time I look at what the ticket costs. Some days it's Friday night and they're charging me $17 to see a movie in Birmingham, Alabama. Other times it's $9. Other times it's $6. Other times it's $5. Other times it's $12. It changes all the time. So they're already doing this. This is not new. But if they're recognizing we're charging too much and we just say, hey, you know what? Monday, Tuesday, Wednesdays, let's just make them all $8, period. See what happens. Okay, great. I'm all for that. But if they're recognizing their tickets are, you know, they may not be too high for inflation in terms of inflation compared to what they were in the 70s, but there are a lot more competitors for your eyeballs. You've got Netflix. You've got a million plays. You pay $15 a month for Netflix. Suddenly you get annoyed when one ticket to one movie is 18.
Well, and part of it is shifting audiences to showtimes that are less crowded, and therefore they want to try.
Well, that's easy. Matinees on Tuesday, matinee prices. You know, they're doing that now. That's not, you know, well, we might try this. They're already doing that. There are already matinee prices all over the country, aren't there? I don't know anywhere.
Yes.
Everywhere I go, there are matinee prices.
Yeah, for the most part. Yeah.
Right. Everywhere I go, there's discount Tuesdays. I remember it as a kid. And now we got it back again with AMC, and other people do it too, especially smaller chains, which are half the chains in this country. So we already have variable pricing.
Well, we should get somebody on the show who could talk about dynamic pricing in the movie business.
But I mean, we already have it. My point was, why is there a big story saying, we were considering this? You're already doing it. If you want to do more of it,
You have to have something to write about during the summer.
There you go. And a bit of a puzzle. Well, there's one new movie called The Legend of Pig Warrior that opened in China. It made about $2 million. And just above it is Midsommar, the horror flick. Last week, it seems to have grossed $4 million. I say seemed because we were puzzled about what was going on with this movie. ComScore reported its worldwide grosses were $40 plus million. And we're like, well, how did that happen? Where did this money come from? There was discrepancy in how many territories it was opened up in. But that total gross worldwide had been repeated elsewhere. Unfortunately, what happens is when they report it, other people just copy that information and it looks like four places are saying, oh, the number says it too. No, they're not. They're just repeating what they saw in ComScore. So now we're back down again. Forget what we said last week. We thought it was confusing and puzzling. We didn't understand quite what was going on. But no, there was not some mysterious midweek jump in Midsommar's take. That movie's worldwide gross is back down to $26 million. So there was some mistake, some fluctuation, some confusion about the movie last week. It was reported as having almost double what it has now. So this week it made $4 million. Its worldwide total is $26 million, which means it's just about tripled its budget. It's a far cry from $50 million, but still, it's profitable, it's looking good, and it may have some legs. But
you know, I have to say that I've looked at a couple of trailers and clips from this film, and it looks pretty interesting. I'm not a big horror fan, but this looks interesting.
Well, our friend Stephen Garrett thought it was a masterpiece. He loved it. 5 stars out of 5 stars at a website I contribute to called Book and Film Globe. Awful name, but fine, fine content. And of course, the biggest news of all, it was announced at Comic-Con. It happened over the weekend. Endgame, Avengers Endgame, is now the biggest hit worldwide of all time, not adjusted for inflation. It passed Avatar, both by grossing money last week and by adding up the money coming in from around the world. When a movie gets towards the end of its run, they always go, oh, we got an extra $2 million here, an extra $1 million there. It's not unusual. It happens, and it happened with this film. So they pulled in some extra money from just doing their accounting and saying, oh, you know, dotting the I's, crossing the T's, and adding up every penny. So now it's at $2.79 billion and counting.
Do you know what every actor, writer, director, agent, and creative person who's ever worked for Disney has said over the weekend?
What?
Hey, do that for all your films.
Well, it's just a couple million bucks, but it adds up. Well, and, you know, maybe I can't make a segue. Forget it. We're moving over to the Middle Kingdom.
Okay, and the Middle Kingdom being where hobbits live. Of course, everybody knows that
the
hobbits.
No, that's Middle Earth.
Oh, I knew it was Middle something.
Yes, no. The Middle Kingdom is another name for China. And in China, a couple of weeks ago, they announced that foreign investors are allowed to put their money in Chinese theater chains.
This would be such a bad idea, in my opinion.
Really? I mean, they own ours.
No,
you think it's a bad idea for Wanda to own AMC or whoever owns AMC?
Well, it depends. If they're allowed to just open theaters.
No. They're not saying you can open your own. They're saying you're allowed to invest in the theater chains that exist in China.
Ah, okay.
They're not saying come on in and open your own chains. No, they're just saying foreign control. You can have foreign control or foreign investment. It's not clear how much control they will allow, if they would allow you to get a majority. But foreign investors are welcome to come in and snap up Chinese theater chain stock.
Yeah, you know, I would say that if it's a full on, you know, investment strategy, okay, fine. But if you're basically saying, hey, now that we've built out in tier one, tier two, and
we want to load off some of our debt.
Yeah, that's basically what they're saying.
Exactly. At the same time, that Shanghai announced that there are two theaters opening up 24 hours a day. Shanghai has a big push to be cultural and have a vibrant nightlife and offering all sorts of fun and exciting things for tourists. And one of them are theaters open 24 hours a day.
Okay.
But don't get too excited. They probably won't be screening The Lion King. A story mentioned that the theaters will focus on quote-unquote main melody films, which naturally had me scrambling for the internet to say, what is a main melody film again?
You know, between Main Melody and The Legend of Pig Warrior, sometimes I think you're just making words. You're just like sticking words together and going, I don't know, I'll just say these three words together and call it a movie title.
Well, given how much bacon I eat, I hope there is no Pig Warrior. But when it when it comes to main melody, that is a phrase meaning films that strike the main melody of what China, meaning the Communist Party, the people in power, want the country to extol and celebrate. And those are patriotic and basically propaganda-oriented films, mostly about war or early Communist Party leaders. And they're usually funded by the government or certainly made with the assistance of the government, such as access to the military for staging some of those big dramatic battle scenes. In other words, they're the boring flicks that people really don't want to see. And who doesn't want to see government-funded propaganda at 3 in the morning?
You know, I was just going to say, that's what you want to go to at, like, you know, a good 4 a.m. Showtime.
Yeah, so China's saying, come on and pick up some of the debt on our theater chains, please. There may be one good reason for that. 13 Chinese studios are listed on their stock market. Most of them are in trouble. Not in trouble, but they're not having a good year. 7 will report a loss in the first half of 2019. They've lost money. 5 of them are going to be reporting lower earnings compared to 1 year earlier, which of course was the biggest year of all time in China. But with majority of them reporting a loss, that is not a good sign. So they're hurting for all sorts of reasons that we've discussed before, including censorship by the government.
Wait a second. You just switched from exhibitors, movie theater chains, to studios. So there is a difference there. I just wanted to point that out.
Well, we were talking about the theater chains are hurting. They want more movies, and the studios that make those movies are also hurting.
Okay.
Nobody's having a great year. Not that the box office overall, it could be the second biggest of all time. We should put that in context, but there is a lot of turmoil in the Chinese film industry going on right now.
And we said last week, part of that is because of the new propaganda division, kind of headed up by a whole new group of people.
That's right. And they're still dealing with the movies that were approved before they took full control. And so there's a disconnect between what they approved and what's coming to screens. And they're like, now that we're looking at this, we don't like this. So two more films have been blocked by the government. First is The Great Wish. This is a ribald teen comedy. There was a lot of good buzz about it. A young guy who's dying and he wants to lose his virginity first.
Okay.
The government, first of all, said, hey, great is not appropriate. You should not call this The Great Wish. That is reserved for the great nation of China, for our great leaders. You should not be using that to all hail Xi, by the way. You should not be using the word great to talk about something like a kid trying to lose his virginity. So they said, fine, okay. We'll change it to The Little Wish or The Last Wish. I'm like, okay, great. But you can't show the movie anyway. They decided, never mind, you're not showing it. They're not interested in Western smut like Porky's and American Pie. So a fun teen comedy that was getting really good buzz apparently will not be seen in theaters anytime soon, if ever. The same has happened to The Hidden Sword. This is a 2-year-old Taiwanese film finally set for release in China, and then it was yanked at the last second. Again, like The 800, that other movie we talked about, this one fell prey to historical accuracy. It's the story of soldiers in the 1930s defending the Great Wall from Japanese attack, and they're armed only with swords. Good Lord. The only problem is that the soldiers were fighting for the Republic of China, meaning the secular people, and not Mao Zedong's army. Secular is not the right word, but the non-Communist Party affiliated group that were battling for control of China. So again, they had the right heroes, but the wrong leader. So they said, never mind, you're not going to show that movie either.
So you're saying that the story idea that I'm pitching to one of these struggling studios in China about kind of a what-if scenario. Call it the Man in the High Great Wall, okay? That you know, where Chiang Kai-shek actually won. And took, that's probably not going to fly?
Well, it would if it was a dystopian nightmare.
Ah, okay.
So it might work. To look at the horrific world you would have lived in if Chiang Kai-shek had won. So yeah, a lot of stuff going on. And you look at the charts in China, there's another Japanese anime film from like 2 or 3 years ago that hit the theaters there. And you feel like they're just grabbing any content they can and throwing it on the screen because they're desperate. You know, they keep missing out on Chinese films. They've got Hollywood swarming the place and making a lot of money. And they just want different content. And they're looking everywhere. Is there a 3-year-old film from India we can put on the screens? I mean, that's what they're doing right now. Because July and August is usually reserved for Chinese films that can play unopposed by Hollywood. This year,
and they've got nothing. Is
this
that the
year,
idea?
They're showing Hollywood films unopposed by Chinese.
And not because they want to, just because they went to the cupboard and went, oh, we're fresh out of Chinese movies.
Exactly.
Yeah, well, I guess that kind of leads us into a story in our sexual misconducts section, which, you know, I had to ask you the other week. I was like, who is this Jeffrey Epstein guy? I was like, why is everybody making such a big deal? Yes, his crimes are horrific. And, you know, he was convicted for them in 2008, 2009. And then I guess he didn't learn his lesson. He kept doing them and was just arrested again for kind of sexual assault against underage girls.
Not quite true, but not quite grasping the fact that he was let off incredibly leniently. And that's become a scandal how man with $1 billion can arrange to not pay the price for his crimes. You know, the deal that was cut back in the early 2000s was a scandal, is horrendous and horrific. And that's part of why it's coming up again. They're saying, good God, this was a miscarriage of justice.
Well, and you might be wondering, okay, how in the world does this relate to you know, the show business thing that you guys are supposed to be talking about, the world of entertainment? Well, a couple things. And before we get into Peggy Siegel, first of all, a Vanity Fair journalist, a former Vanity Fair journalist, came out, I think her name is Vicky Ward, came out and said, you know, I did a story on Jeffrey Epstein, and he showed up to the, you know, the offices one day, went to go speak to Graydon Carter, and all of a sudden, all of this lascivious content with people on the record, girls on the record saying, you know what, I will name myself, I will show my face. Yes, he did molest me. Yes, he did, you know, he did accost me.
And Graydon Carter killed that part of the story.
Yes, Graydon Carter killed that part of the story. Along comes Kim Masters, who says, you know what, I worked for Vanity Fair, and I can tell you that I actually believe Vicky Ward, and here's why. And went through a whole laundry list of issues that she had with stories that Graydon Carter had changed on her to a point where it started to make her look like a bad journalist. So when she had the opportunity to leave, she did.
I think she was under contract, so it's not about leaving as such. And I think she just had more better opportunities elsewhere. I don't think, you know, she had just, they had moved on, she had moved on. But yes,
correct.
She said
yes.
That he changed stories of mine, people in power, you know, put pressure on him, or he was happy to keep them happy. And I saw that happen for stories that were less serious than the one that Vicky was doing. But yes, I've seen this happen and I absolutely believe her. So that brings us to Jeffrey Epstein, who was a power player and a fixture in Hollywood. He was showing up after his conviction, which was headline news. It was not a secret, even though the deal he cut was secret of how horrifically lenient it was. He was at Hollywood parties, at premieres and events all the time, making good, like he's a welcome member of the community again. And that surprised some people. And Peggy Siegel is one big reason. So the Hollywood Reporter and the New York Times did an in-depth look at PR legend Peggy Siegel, who plays a big key role, or at least did, in the annual award season come Oscar time.
I mean, she was one of the big.
Still was, yeah. Has been up to 2 minutes ago. So I thought I would just say, here's another story. It's good reporting by them. Check it out. But then more news happened today. So the story shows her accepting money from Jeffrey Epstein for quote unquote travel expenses. She insisted she stopped taking money from him in 2010, but then of course can't explain why she continued to associate with him and include him in Hollywood events. So if you suddenly realize in 2010 his money was no good, that he was dirty, why did you keep working with him and get him into stuff? She got him back into the social set after his imprisonment and release as a level 3 sex offender. She, trying to defend herself, said, well, she felt he paid his price and it must not have been a big deal because he got such a light sentence, which of course now that sentencing is seen as a travesty. In fact, The fact that he was credibly accused of raping minors has been national headline news as far back as 2006. So Peggy Siegel has no way to say, well, I didn't know how serious this was. She got him into parties, even when the people hosting them might not have been aware he was there. So what she would do, like, if they didn't
or
want
or even
him,
who he was. I mean, remember, right. Just last week when this story broke, well, I had to ask you. I was like, who is he? How did he make his money? He's a billionaire?
He's a Hollywood guy, and a Wall Street guy, and a big power player in politics more than Hollywood. So what she would do is, if she didn't want to keep him secret that he was going to show up, or if she thought they might object, she'd have him be the plus one for someone else. She says, okay, you can come, but you're bringing my friend as the plus one. And people would say, well, okay. And so that's how he would sneak into these parties. So she's in big trouble. And I'm sure she's a little bewildered. They're paying a price now for behavior that was considered fine throughout most of Hollywood history. And suddenly now, just like that, her business is collapsing. Multiple studios and networks who have had current contracts with her, who have been using her right now, have been announcing they are cutting all ties with her. FX, Annapurna, and Netflix have all ended their active relationships with the legendary publicist. And off the record, pretty much everyone else who wasn't currently doing something with her, because this is not the award season, this is summer, they're all saying they now see her as a negative, and they're probably never going to use her again in the future.
Wow, overnight, her business collapses.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's a big deal. You know, it's hard to say, well, you should not have done what you did decades ago, but you're going to pay a price. So just think about that the next time you look the other way.
Well, you did mention big deal, so it must be time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story, we kind of mentioned this just last week, the Broadway musical Waitress has run out of pie, which means I'm leaving, by the way. If there's no pie, I'm not having dinner there. Yes, after 3 years and 9 months, the hit show will shutter in January. It began previews in March of 2016 and was the first Broadway show in history to have an all-female creative team, thanks to its director, Diane Paulus, its book writer, Jesse Nelson, choreographer, Lauren Lataro, and music and lyrics by Sarah Bareilles. In January, it should run at roughly number 57 or so in the all-time list, passing Jekyll and Hyde, but probably not Matilda at number 56. Also saying goodbye, by the way, the Carole King musical, Beautiful, takes its final bow in October after 5 years and 9 months. It will have notched more than 2,400 performances and ranked number 27 on the all-time list. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal. These long-running shows are more and more common, but just to make clear how dramatic a change this is, I mean, number 57, number 27 on the all-time hit for all 100 years of Broadway, these shows are ranking in the top 100 of all-time long runners. So running for 2 or 3 years is really not typical. So you're hitting close to 4 years and 5 years. Those are big, big hits. And they're also based on, an existing catalog, a jukebox musical, and a movie, Waitress. And so that's why you're seeing more and more shows, like a touring version of a new musical version of An Officer and a Gentleman. And that's why Paul McCartney's working on It's a Wonderful Life. He's written a bunch of songs for a musical version of It's a Wonderful Life, with Lee Hall doing the book and collaborating on the lyrics. Lee Hall, of course, worked on Billy Elliot, the Broadway musical. Very, very good, better than the film. And he also worked on the script for Rocket Man, the current Elton John biopic.
Well, it's good to see that Paul McCartney can still get hired. I mean, he's really hurting.
Yes, well, he's well over 64.
Exactly. And we still love him.
Yes.
Go figure. The music industry has gone mostly mobile, of course, but it still makes hundreds of millions of dollars from vinyl and compact discs, even though I can't find them anywhere. And the distribution of albums and singles to independent record stores and the few chains that still carry them has descended into chaos. Maybe that's why I can't find them anywhere. Now, does that sound like hype? That whole little, like, descending chaos. Into chaos. It's not, according to Billboard. All three major labels now use a single distributor named Direct Shot, a company based in Indiana. Warner Music Group just switched to them in April, and that overwhelmed the company. At the same time, a CD manufacturer used by most indies shut down and forced them to use less reliable European sources for their business. And the department chain Target, well, they stopped taking music delivery at its warehouse, and instead, DirectShot now makes deliveries straight to each store, multiplying its problems a thousandfold. So logistically, that's just a nightmare.
I mean, can you imagine, instead of having to go to like 20 or 50 or 70 warehouses, they now have to go to 800 stores. Wow.
Wow. Well, the result of all this, guess what? Disaster on every level for seemingly everyone. Here's the deal. Countless stores told Billboard, the deliveries they get don't even remotely resemble what they ordered, when they arrive at all, by the way. And the way the music industry works, they have to pay for what they're sent. So a store has to pay for everything it receives, even if it's not what they ordered. Fans can't find new releases. Stores are being billed for product they don't want and can't sell. It's not just an inconvenience. Stores may lose customers once and for all, and the billing issues and lost sales may force indies already living on the margins to close up shop for good. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a very big deal. This is what happens when all your eggs are in one basket and there's no competitor. Suddenly, poor DirectShot is overwhelmed. Everyone seems to be focused on it to recognize what a big problem it is. They're all involved in trying to make this problem go away and somehow fix everything. But it's such a tangled mess. And it's a problem. It's not one thing wrong. Everything is going wrong. And it's just a disaster. But, you know, it's summer. They've got a few months before the fall and the Christmas season, but time is running out.
Well, here's the thing, and this happens in all of these logistics industries, or maybe not logistics, but all of these service industries. These content service providers, whether it be Deluxe or Technicolor, or in this case, DirectShot, they're all squeezed by the studios and the labels down to a point where you should just feel honored to be doing business with them. In fact, why don't you pay them to do business with? And so you get to a point where you can't stay in business. You can't actually perform the job they're asking you to do. And it really is, and they pit these companies against one another to a point where they're literally making nothing on each job.
Right.
And I can say this, I speak from experience. It's almost, and I've said this to a number of people in the content service industry. I said, you know, working for a studio is kind of like having cancer. You know you're going to die from it one day. You just don't know when and how long. Now, okay, so let's move on to Seth MacFarlane, because he is the creator of Family Guy and a hugely in-demand TV creator. However, his focus right now is, well, it's on acting. So it's interesting news that his sci-fi show The Orville is moving from the Fox network to Hulu for season 3. The given reason? Well, it's gotten more ambitious in terms of scope and needs more time. The show won't be ready for its scheduled mid-season debut, and MacFarlane doesn't want to rush it, so the Fox network has agreed to let it go to Hulu. After all, it's a 20th Century Fox show. Everyone loves everyone. Aww. But wait, just wait. There's more. A lot more, in fact. For one, Disney now owns the studio and not the network. The numbers on the show don't make as much sense if the Fox network has to pay a big licensing fee. Disney now owns the show and Hulu, so it doesn't have to pay itself really anything. Plus, MacFarlane, well, here's the rub. He has publicly stated his dislike of Fox News and embarrassment over being linked to it in any way. Well, he's now an Imagineer at Disney rather than a Fox employee, so the move pleases him. Plus, his contract is up and everyone wants to be his new home, so Disney is happy to play nice. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal. You know, one of our listeners, Jesse Spencer Smith, who came up 2 weeks ago as well, he sent a link and said, oh, did you hear about this? Why? Why is Orville Watt leaving? He liked it. He knew it was doing good in demos, he thought, on Fox. And it was like a top 20 show in demos. Fox is a rare, success for Fox. It was not a big, big ratings hit, but still it was chugging along. Why would they let the show go? And I tossed off a few reasons I thought. But then when I looked into it, I was like, oh, wow, this is part of the whole changing the guard when Disney gobbles up the 20th Century Fox, and that's separate from Fox Network. Look at all the ramifications that happen here. And in fact, buried in one of the stories, I think it was Hollywood Reporter, they point out that Family Guy and Bob's Burgers and The Simpsons, all currently on Fox, sitting there on, their animated Sunday night, been there for years and years, they may all leave the Fox Network when their current deals are done. Disney may get better deals elsewhere, or they may just want to bring them in-house. And they're going to see more value in doing that than letting Fox have them. And so you can see Fox's Sunday night may suddenly become decimated. So
And it's been there for decades.
Yeah. This is what happens when titans merge and you get one company gets bigger and bigger. Suddenly the ripple effect is huge all the way up and down the schedule through all sorts of unexpected ways. Suddenly Fox isn't showing their own show on their Fox network. Suddenly it's someone else's show, and that changes the value of the show and how they can afford to do it. So there's lots going on there.
I'm going to both Middle Earth and Middle Kingdom with that title. When Titans Merge.
You know, Middle Earth, they just announced their first casting for The Lord of the Rings.
And it was not me.
Not you or me. That's right.
And yet I've been on this diet to keep myself at Hobbit height this whole time. And now I don't even get cast. Unbelievable. Now, the Kennedy Center Honors announced this year's honorees for their lifetime contributions to the arts. They include the band Earth, Wind, and Fire, or for those of us in the know, EWF, the TV show Sesame Street, actress Sally Field, who has been on Sesame Street, conductor Michael Tilson Thomas, and Michael's close and personal friend, singer Linda Ronstadt. The ceremony takes place in December, and we feel confident that President Donald Trump won't attend. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big whoop. You know, acclaimed people get more honors like they have all their life, but it's exciting to see. Very happy for Linda Ronstadt. It just happened a few days after her birthday. I've talked about her before. I think she's one of the most talented and versatile singers of all time. She probably has more great music recorded in more genres than any other act in history. Rock, pop, country, jazz, big band, operetta, children's music, mariachi music. And her collaboration with Dolly Parton and Emmylou Harris, the trio albums, is one of the great projects of all time. Other interesting stuff. This is the first time a TV show has been honored. I don't think it's a good idea, really. It's nice that Sesame Street is there. I'm sorry Jim Henson isn't alive, so they could have just honored him. But that's not what the Kennedy Center Honor is.
I know. It's so strange.
Yeah, I mean, it's an honorable show. But what next? 60 Minutes, the PBS documentary series Independent Lens? I mean, there's all sorts of things they could do, but that's just not who you are. So I'm not quite sure why they felt the need to honor Sesame Street. Great show, of course. You mentioned that Sally Field had been on Sesame Street. That's true of like 70% of the Lincoln Center honorees. They went through a list of all the people who've been Kennedy Center honorees, and have appeared on Sesame Street, and it's like their family. I mean, the crossover is amazing. So that's kind of an interesting fact, but awesome for Linda Ronstadt.
I just want to know who's going to accept the award on Sesame Street's behalf.
I'm sure will it be Kermit? Well, we'll sit in the balcony there, watch the show.
Heidi ho. Goodbye textbook, by the way. Hello, digital rental. One of the biggest textbook publishers in the world is getting rid of print editions. Pearson said 2/3 of its revenue already comes from digital, so now they're going all in. They publish some 1,500 titles in all, and every future edition will be available as an app or ebook download only. They expect prices to range from $40 to $80 for deluxe versions with all sorts of add-on material. Initiatives tied into this include a global learning platform that can be used in conjunction with Amazon's Alexa and an app called AIDA, which provides an artificial intelligence-enabled tutor in calculus. Where was AIDA when I was taking calculus in college? For Pete's sake, I could have used it. Big deal or big whoop?
I think it's a big deal. It just shows a lot of changes in the industry. They can see the falling sales at the grade school, high school, and college level. They can see crowdsourced and crowd-created textbooks becoming more and more common. Cities and states are demanding that school systems use them, and they're saying, we better shift here. We better find out where we can provide added value, like this app or like the platform, and we better damn well lower our prices, which have been $200, $300 for a textbook because you had no choice. Now they're like, yeah, maybe that's too much. So $40 or $80 with lots of gizmos, maybe people won't freak out so much when they pay $50 for a textbook rather than $300, or $150 for a used one. So they're recognizing.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. Yeah. I mean, I was going to ask, what do I do as a student? I can't return all my digital books to the bookstore.
You get no free money back. That's right. That's okay. That's why they're charging less. So they're seeing all the big changes happening in the educational market, and they're trying to stay ahead of the curve.
if I was a bookstore, you know, the
you mean a college bookstore?
Yeah, I would be a little concerned about this.
Well, they've long had a big market of other stuff. If they've depended on textbooks for their money, their margins aren't good on textbooks either. You know, that's like a service where the money they make money is on the other books. And the school jerseys and the school t-shirts and caps, that's where they really make their money. My understanding is that for a long time, the textbook stuff is really just a service that's a big pain in the neck, but they got to do it. Maybe I'm wrong. If you know, if you work in the educational market, you're in one of those college bookstores and you know, Michael, you don't know what you're talking about, which wouldn't be the first time, let us know.
Yes, you can write to us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. Of course, we're on Twitter, where our handle is @showbizsandbox. And we're also on Facebook, facebook.com/showbizsandbox. Now, subscribers are fleeing Netflix in the U.S. Worldwide, Netflix failed to meet their subscriber target. It's a sudden and dramatic disaster for the once powerful company. Okay, not quite. For the second time in history, Netflix lost some subscribers in the U.S. To be specific, they lost 130,000 in the second quarter. I think it's a rounding error, frankly. thanks to a slow quarter of new content and the recent price hikes. The last time they lost subscribers was back in 2011 when they split up DVD and streaming access and, you know, did that whole thing where they were going to, you know, name one thing. Mm-hmm. And then remember that whole
kerfuffle? I do.
Yeah, yeah. Well, worldwide, they added 2.7 million subscribers, well below their target of 5 million. And by the way, that wasn't their target. That was analysts' target.
Well, there's two. There's two. Yeah.
Well, okay. Netflix has 151.6 million subscribers worldwide. So yeah, they're really hurting. Revenue was right on target at $4.9 billion. And earnings per share were a titch higher than expected. So, you know, we should definitely sell their stock. In the U.S., Netflix has reached saturation level. And worldwide, its growth is slowing. With Disney Plus, HBO Max, NBC Universal, Apple TV, we are going to have streaming service.
Absolutely.
You and me, Michael,
absolutely,
we should launch one just because.
We will.
Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, we're saying it's a big whoop. We're trying to put it in context. Everybody else is yelling and screaming, it's the end of Netflix. That's clearly not the case. In North America, they just can't get much bigger. They've got everybody that's going to sign up for Netflix. So you just have, at some point, you have to recognize it's a mature market. And worldwide, they say most of their losses came in markets where they had their big price hikes. If you add you increase your price by a certain percentage, you're going to probably expect to lose some people and have a slowdown. It's also the second quarter. They'll probably add about 7 million people worldwide next quarter, where it's a more vibrant period. The second quarter is usually the slowest of the year. So we're just trying to keep it in context. However, Netflix isn't sitting on their haunches either. They also announced they're prepping a mobile-only version of Netflix, probably for just one device, and that will cost about $3.75 a month. So they're recognizing there are a lot of people with just a phone, and there are people who don't have a lot of money, and they want to reach them too. So they're looking for ways to grow their market. They're worldwide. They've already got a ton of people. But the idea that if they've got 150 million people worldwide, you know you've got a certain amount of money coming in. As long as you don't spend more money on your budgets, you'll be okay, right? It's okay to have a mature business sometimes, but there's still a lot of room for growth with Netflix.
Yeah, so they're trying to eke out some revenue along the edges there. And I guess a part of it is, well, you know, if you already have Netflix, you can use it on your mobile device. So we
this is just people who can't afford a full subscription or don't have a TV. You know, it's nothing to do with.
So they're, like I said, they're lapping up, some revenue.
Up. There's
the
a billion people in India and there's a lot of people in China, and they don't all necessarily want or need a full subscription, but a cheap one for just your phone makes a lot of sense for that world.
Right. It's also another way to compete with Disney Plus at $7 a month. Now, I guess we have some more Netflix news, because until now, Netflix was riding on the coattails of deals made by the major studios. And by deals, we mean, you know, like with the Writers Guild and Directors Guild. It made deals for all its TV shows and movies on a production-by-production basis. No more. Netflix has signed a new 3-year deal with the Actors Guild. They've done so 1 year before the major studios need to work out a new deal, meaning Netflix has gone its own way and in many ways is setting the standard Others may follow. And by others, we mean you, Warner Brothers, Disney, Paramount, etc. SAG-AFTRA, which is the guild in question here, it's an American, you know, actors guild for film and television and even radio actors, they seem pleased. Netflix agreed to improve terms for actors when it comes to dubbing and performance capture, both of which are increasingly in demand, by the way. Better theatrical residuals, which for Netflix, they're like, yeah, it doesn't matter because we don't have any. Minimum salaries and turnaround, regardless of the production's overall budget, better overtime and safety for stunt performers, stricter rules on harassment on set and during auditions, so you have to now harass people on set and during auditions. That's probably what that stands for. With SAG-AFTRA saying Netflix has set the gold standard for fighting harassment. Oh, wait, I take that back. Actually, no harassment. Stop the harassment. That's what Netflix has agreed to. More details will come out, but clearly the major studios will be asked to meet these goals at the very least. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, I think it's a big deal. They're jumping ahead. They're saying, we're going to set the standard. We're going to set the mark. So that's a big change, and they're out a year ahead. And now SAG-AFTRA has already approved a negotiating stance with studios, perhaps trying to get a jump on the DGA, which usually goes first. So Netflix jumped ahead of the studios and signed a deal with SAG-AFTRA first. And now SAG-AFTRA, the actors, are trying to get a leapfrog over the Directors Guild, and they want to set the standard for the contracts with studios. So everybody's fighting everybody to be first, and if that means better deals for the actors and the performers and the people way down on the list, that's a good thing. And one of the things that SAG-AFTRA and Netflix agreed to: no auditions at people's homes, no auditions in hotel rooms, not allowed, never, nada. You know what? You're staying in a hotel. There's a conference room. You can go to the conference room. You don't need to go to somebody's hotel room. So no more about that.
Yeah, I was just going to say, well, what if like you're actually holding the auditions at a hotel and you just do it in the ballroom?
Right. Well, right? Ballroom. Yeah. I mean, there's conference rooms and other, you know, there's plenty of spaces. Yeah. When you're making a movie, you don't have to have people come to your hotel room. If you can't afford anywhere else to meet, then they shouldn't meet with you anyway. And now they can't.
If you need another reminder that it's a big, big world out there and the U.S. is not always the center, here's this. YouTube just published its list of the 10 most popular music videos of 2019 so far. And only one of the 10 is sung completely in English. That would be Ariana Grande's Seven Rings because, you know, that Thank You Next video came out last year. Five of the rest of these songs are sung in Spanish. Two are in Korean, including one by BTS, naturally, and two are from India. Now that's a worldwide chart. Big deal or big whoop?
Yeah, we can get behind that one. I think it's a big deal. Very cool to see. There's a lot of people in the world, and a lot of those songs, even though they are sung in Spanish or mostly in Spanish, have also been hits here in the U.S. So also a cool, and you know, BTS, they are more and more popular here as well. So there's a lot more crossover, a lot more aware of music all over the world, and that's a good thing.
San Diego's Comic-Con took place over the weekend. We were going to have Deadline's Jeff Boucher on the show to talk about all the panels, all the news. Unfortunately, the weekend was too much for fun for Jeff, apparently, who is now feeling under the weather. What do I tell you, Jeff? You have to wear latex gloves. You have to wear the face mask. You know what? Just go in a bubble next time. Don't shake anybody's hand. Okay, well, actually, Jeff, get well soon. Meanwhile, only two major studios bothered to show up at Comic-Con, but since one of them was Disney, lots of news was made. Phase 4 of Marvel's movie plans were mapped out. Wait, is it Phase 4 or 3? I can't even keep up anymore. So two or three movies will be coming out each and every year for years to come. Ugh, good grief. Asian superheroes are clearly ready for their close-up thanks to casting news both in front of and behind the camera. The Eisner Awards.
I'm sorry, the Eisner.
I was, you know, it's funny. When I was doing my little read-through earlier, I was like, well, maybe it is the Eisner Awards. I should look that up. No, I'll just read it the way it's written. The Eisner Awards got criticism for a general vibe akin to the pre-Me Too era, though the actual awards were good, with Giant Days winning Best Ongoing Series and Tom King sweeping most every other award for his work on Batman and the limited run comic Mr. Miracle, obviously about myself. The Russo brothers, they of, you know, Endgame and Infinity War fame, they're going to follow up their work on the Avengers with projects like Grimjack and Battle of the Planets, two properties I don't know a thing about. And those Walking Dead TV movies starring Rick Grimes, remember them? Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, they're actually headed exclusively to movie theaters. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big whoop, right? A weekend of free publicity for the studios, but it sounds like it was a fun weekend. Lots of cool panels. A lot of news was made. Disney and Paramount certainly made the most of their presence. There was a concern that Disney was sort of paying less and less attention to Comic-Con, and they were going to do more on D23, their own convention. Why bother with Comic-Con? But I think they've realized there's a very different audience that comes to Disney's D23. The theme park and classic family stuff that Disney does is not as much overlap with Comic-Con people as perhaps they imagine. I thought, the studios don't matter as much. Maybe that will let Comic-Con breathe and get back to its origins a little bit. I think Jeff felt that that was sort of a spot-on idea. But when we look back at the weekend, there sure is a hell of a lot of news coming from the studios. I mean, yeah. The two movies in 2020 from Marvel, Black Widow in May and Eternals in November. There'll be three in 2021, Shang-Chi and the Legend of the Ten Rings in February, Doctor Strange and the Multiverse of Madness in May, and Thor, Love and Thunder in November 2021. Shang-Chi made news by announcing who was cast as the lead in that Asian-oriented flick. Doctor Strange said they're going to be the first scary Marvel movie. They're going for a scary, spooky horror film sort of vibe. It's going to be PG-13, and they want to scare the daylights out of you. Oh, plus there will be five more films that haven't a release date yet, but they're definitely coming. Black Panther 2, Captain Marvel 2, Guardians of the Galaxy 3, another Fantastic Four reboot, and Blade reboot with Mahershala Ali. So
wow. Tons, so just a little news.
Just a lot of news. Yeah. So sorry we couldn't have Jeff here. But yeah, I knew Battle of the Planets. That's a Japanese TV series that came to the US. It's got sort of an environmental theme. In fact, in the original series, there's even a transgender character. So that's a little unusual, though they hid that in the US version. But I understood Battle of the Planets. But Grimjack, the other project from the Russo brothers, I'm like, I have no idea what that is. So I looked it up on Wikipedia. It's this guy who's in a city that is present in every part of the multiverse. So whatever universe you go to, that city is always there. It's sort of like at the center of the multiverse. And it's sort of a Wild West sort of vibe. And Grimjack is our hero. And he has an ongoing battle with his brothers and all these other people. He has an evil stepbrother named Nick. And I just loved this. I was trying to figure out what it was about and what it might be like. And I came to this particular moment in Wikipedia where it says, our hero, John Gaunt, is the hero. And he says, at age 30, John Gaunt had a final fateful confrontation with his brothers. Nick is that evil stepbrother. Nick shot John, leading Joe to draw his gun and shoot Nick. Jake then shot Joe, and Joe shot Jake. John shot Nick. Jake shot Joe again, killing him. John then finished Jake. Nick shot John again, and John killed Nick.
Who's on first? I've got no idea what the heck.
I read it 10 times, and I still don't know what happened. But everybody shot everybody. But thank you, Wikipedia.
Yeah, well, Love and Thunder, by the way,
yes,
comes out in November 2021
with Natalie Portman playing the Thor goddess.
Yeah, that's my nickname in college, Love and Thunder. But that wraps up Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week and moves us along to Inside Baseball. Inside Baseball is where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. And here's how this week's story affect you. Which shows will get that nice needed boost to last another season, two or three, because they won Emmys?
Yeah, really. I mean, in today's fragmented TV watching, almost every show can benefit from Emmy attention. It's the rare show that doesn't need it. Surely you think everyone knows about shows like Stranger Things or The Handmaid's Tale and The Good Fight. But audiences are usually a lot smaller on cable and streaming, and even network shows need some love. So yes, everyone but perhaps Game of Thrones needs a boost. But assuming attention from the media means people are pretty aware of a show already, which Emmy nominees will be getting a boost they really need? So this isn't a big story. It's just a little quick one. But it does, look at the Emmys and say they still have a major role to play now more than ever, perhaps, with so many shows on so many platforms. It is the swan song to Game of Thrones, and I think if attention had been paid, if news had been made, it would have been if Game of Thrones did not get nominated for Best Drama because of its widely criticized final season. And of course, the creators of Game of Thrones ended up not going to Comic-Con because they decided it wasn't going to be fun listening to people go, "You ruined Game of Thrones."
I thought that Trevor Noah's joke about, like, what should happen is that, for Best Drama Series, mm-hmm. they should give it to Sesame Street. Right. And just like out of nowhere. And then when they complain about it, say, "Oh, now you like endings that make sense."
Game of Thrones is up for it. And Veep is up for Best Comedy. And they are probably considered the front runners. Even if they win, does this mean the end of an era for HBO? You know, is
they'll come up with other shows.
They always do, right? It was the end of an era after Sex and the City. It was an end of an era after The Sopranos. It was an end of an era after, you know, multiple
girls after. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, HBO is, you know, it's got Westworld. They had a trailer at Comic-Con and people were excited by it. I stopped watching long ago, but I know other people haven't. We'll have to see if that one keeps growing.
Now, here's the thing that the Emmys do these days, okay? Mm-hmm. And what I mean by that, the benefit to them is that there are shows out there that I have never heard of that get Emmy love. Okay, so let's talk about, I'm going to skip over the first one since we are a children's show. And it does have a little curse word in it.
It does not have a curse word in it.
Shite's Creek?
Well, but it's Shit's Creek, but it's S-C-H-I-T-T apostrophe S. That's the joke. It's Eugene Levy, and this is a show that airs on Pop TV, and I feel like this is an early reward, an early thank you to Pop TV for picking up One Day at a Time. They picked up One Day at a Time and said, we're going to pair it with our most beloved show. Schitt's Creek is having its final season. We're going to have that show followed by One Day at a Time, and then hopefully more and more seasons after that from One Day at a Time. And I feel like it's a really big boost for a very small show on a small cable channel, and I think of any show that we mention, this one could get the biggest boost in attention because people go, where the heck is Pop TV on my cable channel? I'll have to figure this out.
Well, and the funny thing is most people will probably be looking on their streaming channel saying, oh, I don't have a subscription to Pop TV.
Exactly.
Now, Fleabag is a show everybody's been talking about. So I had heard about
it. Of course.
It got tons of press, you know, it got Emmy nominations, just made it a major player this year. And The Good Place, of course, I'd heard about, right? We've talked about it on this show. Nailed it. A Netflix baking show? No idea what it is.
Well, there you go.
Never seen it.
Again, this is well known. People have talked about it. But nonetheless, right, getting Emmy love, having people talk about it again, say, oh, here's a really cool cooking show. You should check it out. That's the sort of thing that can happen. And The Good Place has never been huge. So that's the Ted Danson, Kristen Bell show. Very fun to see. You know, he's got a new show already. They're entering their final season. He's got a new show lined up with, I forget what network, but it's going to be, he's playing the mayor of Los Angeles. And that's cool to see. And Fleabag, we think Fleabag, everybody knows it or wants to see it, has already heard about it. That's just not the case. But going up for best comedy, best director, best writing, all the female stars on the show got nominations. That really shows people, hey, this is a show you should pay attention to. And it can still has a lot of room to grow when it comes to audience. And the same is true, I guess, of Russian Doll. You've heard of that one, right?
Yes, I have. Natasha Lyonne's series. I've never seen it.
I've never seen it
either. But now I'm now more interested in taking a look.
Absolutely. Same is true perhaps for BoJack Horseman, one of the most acclaimed sitcoms of the last few years. It's an animated show. It finally got nominated for Best Animated Show, long overdue. You know, that and Archer and The Simpsons. And, you know, there are shows that there's a lot of love for some of these shows, but it's not even always reflected in Emmy time. But BoJack really has the sort of breakout episodes and plot lines that sort of should make it step out. And so finally, the Emmys have caught up with one of the most acclaimed shows in years.
And finally, Bruce Springsteen might win an Emmy.
Finally, so long overdue. So he's won a Grammy, of course. He's won the Oscar. He's gotten an honorary Tony. So there's a little asterisk by that. But now that he's up for an Emmy for his special filmed on Broadway, the EGOT is in reach for Bruce Springsteen. Even if there's an asterisk after it, he'll take it.
Well, it'll be interesting to see, you know, if people, because that was a Netflix show, so it'll be interesting to see if they look, I'm sure that was like in the live, show category or something like that, right?
I don't know what a concert special or, I mean, TV special or whatever it was under.
Maybe.
I don't know what it was. But the big question now is, will the Emmys do a good job of introducing these shows to viewers? Because that should be their job, and they do a bad job filling it up with a bunch of nonsense, filling up with comedy bits. Give people a flavor for these shows because you know what? They don't know what Russian Doll is. They don't know what Nailed It is, that cooking show. They don't know Schitt's Creek with Eugene Levy. Longer, substantial clips, really giving people a sense of the show. Yes, they can Google them on YouTube, but crafting them well and presenting them and make them compelling and make people say, even if the show doesn't win, wow, I want to check that out. That should be the Emmy show's job. That's their job. Let's see if they even try to do it.
I'm predicting now they won't.
That's right. But it is time. We were ending Inside Baseball and heading into the obituary section. Before we get to the one person that we're covering, an Italian crime writer, a couple things have happened this week. First of all, today, we're recording on Monday, filming has halted on Fast and Furious 9. Thank God he didn't die, but a stunt person has suffered a serious head injury today on the set of that film where it's shooting in London.
That's not the case for the DC show Titans, where a crew member did die.
That's right. A special effects coordinator, Warren Appleby, he was killed during a rehearsal for a car stunt when a piece of the car broke off. That just shows you how dangerous, you know, we take all these stunts and things for granted and think they're all digital effects, but there's a lot of dangerous stuff going on when people are filming on TV and film, and, you know, people try to one-up each other, but I can't imagine anyone anywhere thinking anything is more important than making sure people are safe and that nobody gets seriously injured or dies just for doing a stunt for a movie or a TV show. So that's always got to be first in mind. But those are perhaps, maybe there'll be lessons that can be learned. So if those are preventable deaths or things we can learn, they'll take those lessons from them and change the way things are done so that at least some good can come out of it. No good can come out of the horrific event that happened in Japan this week. There was an arson attack at the Kyoto Animation Studios in Japan. 34 people are dead so far. They just upped the death total. Several dozen people are seriously injured or injured. It's the worst mass murder in the post-war history of Japan. We didn't know what was going on at first. I came up with a few conspiracy theories about misogyny, but it turns out this person had been in jail. They had mental health issues, and the person hasn't been interviewed yet because they injured themselves and caught on fire. But that this person imagined that somehow Kyoto stole their ideas because they have annual contests where people are allowed to submit in ideas. This mentally is unstable. This is what we're talking about. Japan does not have the history of violence that you see in the U.S., so this is doubly horrifying there. In the U.S., we have one mass shooting, meaning four or more people are injured or killed. We have about one mass shooting a day in the United States, which is why nowadays when kids are gunned down in schools, it makes news for about 48 hours and then we move on, which is horrific and awful. In Japan, this is really a nightmare. In Kyoto, not really a big profile in the rest of the world. They specialize in stories about high school girls, but it's one of the good companies. From everything I can gather, they have salaried employees working on their animation rather than freelancers who are paid by the frame. That's the majority of their workers are salaried employees. And the animation and video game industries are terrible in terms of freelancers and how they burn through people and the long hours and poor pay. So Kyoto is one of the good guys, is from what I can gather in this case. It doesn't mean, you know, it would be okay if they weren't, but it's one more sad fact about this company that focuses on stories for girls and young women, and that they're good with their employees, that they suffer this horrific attack is just a real nightmare.
Well, now you want to highlight this Italian crime writer, Andrea Camilleri, who died at the age of 93. I had never heard of this person.
Well, neither had I. You know, it's easy to pretend we had, but I hadn't. Once I read about him, I think I have heard about Inspector Montalbano before. But anyway, at the age of 70, this guy, Andrea Camilleri, he'd written some historical novels, never really broke out. But at the age of 70, this is 23 years ago, but just at the age of 70, he said, I'm going to write a mystery novel. And he wrote one starring a Sicilian named Inspector Montalbano. Several dozen novels have followed in the last 23 years. He sold 30 million copies worldwide, and there's a hit TV series, which I am not aware of, but I'll have to check it out. His death, if you want to know how big he was in Italy, his death prompted comments from the president of Italy, among many other major figures in that country. But he's not universally beloved because he's very progressive, and he's been a sharp critic of fascists. And in fact, he included a modest pro-migrant message in a recent episode of the TV series, Inspector Montalbano, and that drew outrage from far-right critics. Mostly, he refused to give the mafia or mafioso center stage in his novels. Even if they were villains, he felt like if you put them in the book and gave them a big role, you would be giving them the spotlight, and they didn't deserve that. So that was one of the big things he did. And there will be one final Inspector Montalbano novel, number 28. Because 13 years ago, he wrote the final volume in the series, and then he locked it in his publisher's office for safekeeping. He said if he died or if he got sick of the character, just publish that book and that'll be the end of it. So that's cool.
Smart guy.
Agatha Christie did the same thing with curtains for what's his name? The Little Gray Cells in Poirot. So she did that as well. She had planned in advance. She said, all right, this is going to be the final Poirot novel. And she wrote that. So maybe he took a cue from her. But, you know, fascinating guy, fun guy. I like his politics. And I'm going to check out his book and or TV series.
And, you know, little did I realize, I've always liked his cigars.
Yes,
actually.
Of course.
When my kids were born, I handed out Montalbano. Oh. Maybe that was Monte Cristo.
Maybe so,
actually.
Maybe so.
Yeah. But that wraps up our show for this week in record time. But that doesn't mean you shouldn't subscribe to our show on iTunes, the Google Play Store, Microsoft, the Marketplace, Stitcher, anywhere they give podcasts away for free. You should subscribe to our show so you won't miss the next one. You should rate and review our show so, you know, that way, you know, other people can find it. And it helps us out when you do that as well. That information, ways to subscribe to us, can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's where you'll find links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode, as well as ways to contact us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. Or you can leave us a voicemail at 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. We're also on Twitter, as I mentioned, @showbizsandbox is our handle. Or you can like us on Facebook, facebook.com/showbizsandbox. That information, again, on our website, showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Giltz has a website, and every week it's something new and exciting. What is it this week, Michael?
This week it's IKnowWhoSgonnaWinTheOscarForBestActor.com.
Okay, who?
Tom Hanks. I just saw the trailer for A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood, where he plays the lovable Mr. Rogers. I'm like, oh, yeah. Oh, he's got the Oscar. I just feel like it in my bones. I'm like, people want to have that character around. They love Tom Hanks. It's a perfect merger of guy and character. It'll be fun to see.
Mr. Edgerton, we're very sorry, but Elton John will just, you know, won't do it for
you.
I'd
be happy to buy you a drink.
Well, if you can't find any of Michael's coverage of the entertainment industry there, why not head on over to michaelgiltz.com, where all of his work is aggregated. Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.